do your reading. People that are not looking me in the eye didn't do their reading.
What did you say?
Did you do your reading? Did you read the book this week?
Yeah.
What were you supposed to read?
The book,
chapter 2.
Payne didn't read. You wouldn't lie to me. Which Payne? Chapter 2, y'all.
Yes.
We're at the end of chapter 1.
I'm
for some reason, I believe you, Payne.
It's a lot easier to read than chapter 1.
What's that?
It's a lot easier to read chapter 2 than chapter 1.
Yeah. You think so?
Yes.
Just wait. Just wait. Well, Francis Chan has an interesting way to write. If you haven't noticed already, he's interesting the way that he phrases stuff. And so chapter 2 is a pretty good Chanian chapter. He's just like, well, basically, you could die before you're done reading this chapter, which is a pretty shocking way. Have you heard of the, my mom's talking a whole lot. Hi, son. Hi, everyone. Only chapter 2. Good job, Mom. Happy birthday, Dee, from my mother in Virginia. Isn't she sweet? Yeah. Before we get into class, we're already in class, but before we get in class, we FaceTimed my mother a couple of weeks ago. So Maddie was holding the phone and looking at her, and my mom was talking. If you've not met my mom and you don't remember her voice, sorry, Mom, her voice is high-pitched. It's when she goes to a drive-through. Sometimes she'll try to order food, and they'll say, put your mom on the phone or put your mom on the speaker. You can't order, little girl, because her voice is really up here. It's just my mom's voice all the time. Until she gets mad and drops down to a baritone for some reason. Anyway, so Maddie was listening to my mom, say, hi, Maddie, how's it going? Are you having a good night? And Maddie goes, hi, Grandma, mama. And she's like mocking her. And I was like, wait a second. I was like, Mom, talk again. Hi, Maddie, how are you? Hey, my grandma. I'm like, she's putting on her grandma voice, which is super high pitched. That is the cutest thing in the world. So she loves mocking my mom. It's fun. Kind of like me, I would never do such a thing. Nowadays, too much. Okay, so chapter 1 talks about the idea of basically stop praying, meaning before you pray, stop for a minute and just think about to whom we're speaking. Like, God is God, after all. And we talked a lot last week about the idea of what that kind of looks like. I want to go through a couple of verses before we get too far into the end of chapter 1. So he describes God in a particular way. We already covered this? No. We didn't, did we? If we do, stop me. God is holy. We talked about that one. I'm pretty sure we talked about holiness. We didn't actually go to the passages that he mentions. So Exodus 3:14, we have this passage being the one where Moses is before the burning bush, right? And God is speaking to him. And his first kind of excuse, we might say, would be, well, if I go to the Israelites, the Hebrews, and I tell them that God sent me, and they ask me for your name, I don't know what your name is. Which is interesting, because before this, we don't have any writings that God has revealed a name, per se. So maybe he was just trying to say, well, maybe God won't tell me his name, so if I ask him for a name, he can find somebody else. Or it's the fact that they already kind of had an idea of who it was, passed down through the patriarchy, and now Moses kind of needs that information. Whatever the case, he gives the phrase, I am who I am, right? So what's the meaning behind that name, I am who I am? Or in the King James, I am that I am. What's that mean? Not everybody at once.
The
great I am. We get the word Yahweh, which is kind of four letters in the Hebrew. We don't really know what the vowels are, so we kind of make it look like Jehovah sometimes. There's one idea. Some translations actually have Jehovah, like the ASV of 1901 has that. For every time the name of God is used, they put Jehovah to tell you that's the name of God. Some translations have a lower font size, but all capitalized, L-O-R-D for Lord. That's not Adonai, that's Yahweh right there. It's not just God, creator, but that's his name used there. And so God is holy is the idea. And we were in the idea of, we were in the text rather, discussing the idea of him being before the throne. You have the seraphim, which are the flying snake monsters up there, angels up there rather. And they're around the throne. And what's their dialogue? Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty in Revelation, right? So we have that song that's fitting in that. Next, he is eternal, right? So what's it mean to be eternal? Which is, by the way, what I was looking for with the I am. It's not the I was or I will be. It's the I am in the present tense, meaning he is now. He always was. He always will be. He's eternal. So what's that look like for you?
It's hard for me to understand it because time, I'm bound by time. God created time for me, mankind. So it's really hard for me to think about that aspect of God being eternal.
Yeah, it's beyond us, right? We are bound by time. We have a birth, right? And then we live, and then we die. So there's a timeline there for us, and there's an end point of that in the physical sense. In the spiritual sense, we're eternal. And for the longest time, I had a really, really, really hard time, probably still do, trying to comprehend how a thing can have a beginning and then never have an end, right? So God, as far as we know, never had a beginning by our definitions, nor will he ever have an end. That's the idea of God's infiniteness, making our world bound by space and time and matter and weight and so on. So we come into the world at a certain point. We have a start, right? We can say conception, we say birth, we have a beginning point of us. So how can we start life and then really, in a spiritual sense, never end it? How does that work? And one kind of clue, I think, may be a couple of times that God has told specific individuals about what their job was to be, what their role was to be. Jeremiah, for example, before he was formed in the womb, God called him to be the person he needed him to be a prophet of God. We're studying Galatians for our study group for Bible Bowl, and there's a part in that where Paul just kind of flippantly says, before I was formed in my mother's womb. So it's the idea of, yeah, there's that beginning point, but even before that, in the mind of God, we existed, which is a weird thing to think about. How can you know something is going to exist without really causing it to exist, in a primary way? It's an interesting concept. Jim?
It's kind of like trying to understand the universe. If there's an end to it, what's on the other side of that?
Yeah, yeah. And if there's a big bang at the beginning, what caused the big bang, right? There's no line where you can get to and say, that's it. That's all there is. So God is holy, he is eternal, he's all-knowing. What's the fancy English word for that? Omnipotent is all-powerful. So all-knowing is omniscient. So I have a hard time saying
smart.
Those words. What's that?
Smart.
Smart? God's smart? Well, yeah, I suppose. You'd have to be, right? All-knowing. Let's do Psalm 139. I don't want to belabor the point here, but I do want to cover the text in a fair way. My tendency, problem would be just to kind of say, okay, this chapter's about this, here's some stuff, moving on. And there's a whole lot more than just that. So I would strongly encourage you, if you have not read the chapter, I'm not going to try to embarrass you, but just give it the attention it deserves, because it really is worth your time. We'll do a couple of verses of this, then move forward. Okay, Psalm 139. So we see here the title. The title comes from the Hebrew manuscripts. Sometimes we have some words there in the Hebrew, we don't know what they mean. It could be like tempo, it could be meter, it could be what instrument to use, it could be who wrote it, it could be when it was performed on a certain day. Whatever the case, we just have a Psalm of David here for the second clause. So, verse 1. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. This is New King James. You comprehend my path and my lying down. and are acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You have hedged me behind and before. You laid your hand upon me, for such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. And verse 7, where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, the grave, the pit, hell, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. So we'll pause here, and you get the point. David's kind of making a poem here, a song with the idea of there's nowhere he can go where God's not there, and all-knowing, all-present. And so in remarking about God, yeah, he's holy, he's eternal, he's omniscient, and now he's omnipotent, or omnipotent, if you want to say it wrong, which I often do.
And everything David said, we can say about ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was inspired, obviously, so the idea about where can I flee from your spirit could be a reference to him trying to get away from that inspired kind of role that he had, or it could just be a general remark about the idea of how can you flee from God. But whatever the case, it's definitely true of us. Sometimes we love to just kind of fool ourselves into thinking that no one knows something, right? Well,
Jonah tried.
What's that?
I said Jonah tried.
Jonah tried, yeah. He tried to flee from God's presence. Then a great fish came along and reminded him he was in charge. All right, Colossians chapter 1, verse 16. This is talking specifically about Jesus here. If we look at verse 15, for example, he is the image, or the imprint, literally, of the invisible God. So if you want a picture of who God is, Paul says, look at Christ. That's God in the flesh. The firstborn over all creation, that word firstborn just means kind of first or preeminent. He's not the first created being, which some people have kind of supposed from that. But anyway, verse 16, for by him, or because by him, were all things created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. So what do you think he means by visible and invisible? We ain't never going to know. Okay. Okay. We're never going to really understand or experience all the things that God made. What else do you think he means in this context specifically? Let's keep reading. Whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. That's the explanation. So what are those four things? Do you remember? Whenever you see that phraseology, thrones, dominions, principalities, or powers, we're talking about the idea of leadership structure for the spiritual realm, whatever that means. You have Michael, the archangel, right? If you have an archangel, you have to have under angels. Then there's one above him, it would seem like, who's the creator. And so the idea here of verse 16, either visible or invisible, I think he's talking specifically here in this context anyway about the idea of things that we can see, like the created world, or things that are beyond this physical creation bound by space and time, meaning whatever it looks like beyond this, he made that too. And we'll experience that one day. Okay, next, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist, which is, again, one of those things where we're bound by space and time. My body is right here, your body is right there, we are different locations. But then Acts 17, Paul says, for in him we move and live and have our being. If you're looking for the unknown God, you're in him, but also he's in heaven, but also he's out there in judgment. So it's kind of one of those deals where, yeah, he's all-knowing, he's all-powerful, and through that he made all the things that are bound by space and time, like our world, and things that are outside of that realm called the so-called spiritual realm. Okay, thoughts? God is fair and just. which is a point of contention for a guy named C.S. Lewis. At the very beginning of the book, Mere Christianity, he says there has to be a God, and here's why. Because we all have a ingrained knowledge of what is right and what is wrong, meaning what is fair and unfair. He uses the illustration of kids playing baseball, right? If kids are just playing baseball, just a fun competitive game, and then you have a guy hitting the ball, and then he runs, and then you have a kid throw the ball to the guy on the bag at first base. He taps the bag, taps the person, he should be out. But what if he says, I'm not out, and he just keeps running and says, I got a home run. Is that fair? Why?
Not playing by the rules.
Not playing by the rules. What rules? Who cares? The rules of baseball. Well, we have this innate feeling within us of things are fair or unfair, right? A kid walks over to your kid and just steals one of their toys and runs off with it. What are you going to do? Go tackle that kid, right? Give my kid their toy back. Why? What's it matter? And that was, well, this is a side note. Here we go. This rabbit's fun, though. That was my problem when I was a kid, was I was told, right, basically through culture and through people and kind of by teachers as well, but not as harshly as you might assume, that, you know, we're here and we came through originally a single cell organism, and then we grew over a long time and became tadpoles, and then we became kind of frogs, and those frog legs became legs, and then we were these weird looking bird things, and then we were eventually primates, and then we were eventually us. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. If I go and I kill someone, why are you mad about that? Why do we feel so strongly about the idea of murder? I wasn't trying to murder anybody, but I'm just saying, if we're just animals that have evolved through nature by being dominant, then why not go be dominant? Why do we have to live civilly anymore? That doesn't make any sense to me. Our culture, our society is nothing if we came from these primates. What are we doing here? We're lying to ourselves. And so that was kind of my angst coming through. And I was like, there's no meaning to any of it. Just throw it all away. It's nihilism. Nothing means anything. That was kind of like, well, is there anything worthwhile?
Did you really feel that?
Yeah, I sure did. I mean, yeah, I did.
You did?
I did. I was like, if we're just evolved primates, then nothing matters. Throw me in jail. What does it matter? Why do you have the right to put me in jail? You're a person just like me. There's no hierarchy. There's no structure. There's no law. Law's made up. It's all fabrication. And either you get to that point and you just say, well, life is meaningless, so therefore I'm taking myself out of it. Or you say, let me look for the real meaning of what's this whole thing about. And then they showed me these stories. And Jesus is like, okay, life is like a big old net that's going through the sea. And you collect a bunch of different stuff. But you get to choose what kind of fish you want to be in that net. Do you want to be on the right side or the left side? You get to make that choice. And you make that choice based on who you follow. Do you want to follow the way of the world, which to me was like meaningless, nihilism, or do you want to follow Jesus and see what he has to say? So that's what I did, and that's kind of where we are. So, I mean, I talk about myself way too much anyway, but when I read that God is fair and just, I'm like, yep, that's the thing, because I couldn't get over the idea if we had a sense of right and wrong. But if we were just evolved primates, that sense of right and wrong is a hindrance to our evolution from this point forward. Right, Thomas? So.
But when you think of the phrase fair and just,
yeah,
you think of no preconceived bias, those types of things. In my work career, I've used the phrase back hallway conversation, and as much as I know that I've come across many, many good people who sit on the bench, I also know from back hallway conversations that they have their own opinions, their own sense of fairness, and they can be influenced just like everybody else. I'm not saying that, you know, their decisions, but it comes into play. So whenever you think God is fair and just, hear that phrase, you want it to be that the person who is ultimately making the decision, there's no bias. And we read that all the time, that he's not a respecter of persons. It doesn't matter what you look like, what you feel like, it's on the inside. The whitewashed walls and everything else that we read about. So, I mean, that's what's important, is that we know that who our value system comes from, there's no preconceived bias.
Yeah, it's not perfect, right? Our sense of justice, we do have those back hallway conversations. We have a perspective. We have a dog in the fight because we're a part of that society. If you look at and you step away from the details of like Leviticus and Numbers and just look at the legal system of the Israelite nation, outside the sacrifices and all that for God, but just how they were to treat one another, it's primitive in the sense of like, hey, if you accidentally kill a slave, here's how much money you owe the master, right? Or if you steal an ox, here's your penalty and so on. But there's that sense of him trying to show them what's fair and just. And we can, you know, talk about this if you really, really want to. I really don't. But our government itself is kind of built upon similar principles, right? Even at the beginning, we take our existing society, culture, and laws, we leave England for a bit, and then now we make our own thing. And sometimes we take some of their laws, sometimes we go back even older than that. But the point is, we're trying to reach this level of fairness that we're never truly going to attain. It's at God's level because of our fallibility, which is fine because there's still the judge awaiting. That was funny to somebody, I guess. Anyway, so God is fair and just. I don't know where I got this thing from. I can't remember. But there is a story or line or something where if you are a cop, right, you're a detective, trying to figure out who committed a crime, you bring in a suspect and you ask them, hey, if you were judge and you found the guy guilty of doing this crime, what would you say be done to them? And if the guy goes, well, you know, he might have made a mistake, he's human, maybe you should go easy on him, then maybe that guy's guilty because he's like, I made a mistake, right? But if you got a guy saying, no, hang the guy, like, you know, take him out, execute, like, oh, maybe he didn't do it, right? That kind of shows us our bias here when we come to a legal situation. But when it comes to God's forgiveness and mercy and grace, do you want to be forgiven of your sin? Do you want everybody else to be forgiven of their sins? You guys nod your head. You want to get real for a second?
It's not always easy, because there are some people who commit what we consider atrocious things that are hard to get past. But Jesus Christ got past things that were done atrociously.
Let's use the media just for an easy illustration quickly, and then we'll move on.
Not
the media situation going on right now. In Texas, right? Everyone aware of what happened in Texas at Church of Christ?
Yes.
Okay, there's an article in our bulletin most weeks from a guy named Wes McAdams. He's right next to where this church was, Texas. And a guy came in there. He was a benevolence individual, as far as we're aware. He was looking for money. They gave him food a couple of times, but he was also severely mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And he came in looking for money. The church said no. And so he came in a couple weeks later wearing a wig and a fake beard and a long three-quarters length coat. And he had a shotgun under that coat. And if you've seen the media, you know he took two people's lives that day before he was put down. And there were people at that congregation who were interviewed the very next week. And they said, we forgive him for what he did. He killed someone's daddy that morning. If you've seen the footage, you know that daughter came right to that man that was killed first. And to have someone from that church say, we forgive him for taking his life, that's a bit more difficult than just saying, we want everybody to go to heaven, right? When someone has taken something from you at that level, we have a hesitancy there. And that's my point of talking about God is fair and just. Thank God he is fair and just, because we can't be fair and just to a true point. We have opinions, we have feelings, we have emotions, and that those matter. They're important, but ultimately when it comes to eternity, we need someone on the outside of that to be objective and to be fair and just, and he's that standard that we try to reach in our society and even individually. And there are many more examples like that within the brotherhood. I mean, you guys know Dan Winkler. That's the one that we've talked about a lot. His son was killed by his wife. Then the wife admitted, "I shot your son in the back with a shotgun. Can you forgive me?" And he hugged her and said, "I forgive you." That's a man, way beyond what I can ever begin to think about. Okay, so last thing for chapter 1, then we'll move on to chapter 2. The idea of God being fair and just is important, and then God as the creator has the right. He has the right not only to be worshipped, but to be recognized for who he truly is. And that's really the idea of going to him before the throne that we began with. You try to imagine what God is like, and we get little clues about who he is and what he looks like and what's around him to kind of give us that image of when we go before the throne, when we pray to God, when we worship him through song, we need to remember what we're doing here. We're not just singing a song, trying to get the melody right and the pitch right and the timing right and the words right. We are going to the God that made everything with our hearts opened to express how thankful we are that he is what he is. Or who he is. Okay. Any more questions, comments? Chapter 1. All right. So not bad, right? It's a nice way of putting things, I think. I like the way he describes it because it kind of is different than what I'm used to hearing. You know, when you hear prayer, usually talk about reverence, talk about the Lord's Prayer, how to pray, who to talk to, what to focus on, not to focus on, but talking about who God is that we're going to approach is a different thought for me, anyway. Okay, chapter 2. You could die before you finish reading this chapter. Well, thanks, Francis, for reminding us of the things that we sometimes try to not remind ourselves of. Life is one of those things that's completely unpredictable, right? You never know what's going to happen. But we have this need within us to feel that safety of security. You know, we feel like we can control everything, which is really stepping on my toes a bit. We have this need to, when we feel out of control, to control at least what we can control. And that's kind of us resorting into ourselves, into our fear. But God doesn't want us to be fearful. I mean, if you do a study of the times that God says to individuals, "Don't be afraid," they were about to do some wild stuff. And one option was to give into that fear and to be maybe self-reliant or reliant on their own military or government or people or friends or whatever. The other option was give it to God, truly, not just saying that phrase, but give it to God, know that he's still in control. You can trust him because he sees beyond this next obstacle to your eternity. That's one concept, by the way, from the book of Job, right? That was Job's real issue, I think, was he kind of forgot who God was. The big deal was he had a lot of tragedy in his life. I mean, who had abandoned him? Well, his family was gone. His business and slaves were gone. His wealth was gone. His friends thought that he was some great sinner, though he wasn't. Satan said, as soon as you take away his stuff, he'll curse your face. So even Satan's against him, ironically, as the adversary, seems pretty fitting. God was the only one really in his corner. His own wife. What did his wife say before the great dialogues began?
"Curse God and die."
Curse God and die. Well, okay. Thanks, hon.
That's fair and just.
What's that? That's fair and just. I mean, if your own wife says, all you got to do now is curse God and just die. Like, they didn't have life insurance. What was her game? Like, was she want to remarry or something? Like, come on now.
She was tired of hearing
him complain about it? Well, I'm just so glad that you don't have
her opportunity.
I, Tess, I mean, she had it pretty good, except for the whole boils and sitting in ashes and scratching us up with pot shards. I mean, what a hunk, am I right? All right. Anyway, what's my point? Job, his whole point was, look, I don't know what's going on. Why is God doing this to me? The point was, God wasn't doing this to him, right? That was the whole point. All his friends are like, well, I mean, obviously the evidence suggests that you are being punished for your sins. Something is going on here. I mean, a just God wouldn't punish you if you didn't do something wrong. He's like, I didn't do anything wrong. But I can't just talk to God. There's no one standing in between me and God to explain both sides. Hint, hint. Maybe I need a mediator. Hint, hint. A couple thousand years later. And then Job's finally like, all right. And then God speaks. And if you want to boil what God said to Job, it's a little harsh, right? What were the statements? It begins almost every time with, where were you, Job, when I made the world just the way it was? Where were you when I put the stars exactly where they should have been? Did I consult you when I made this crazy-looking beast that you have around you nowadays? Did I need your permission to make all these things? And Job's like, no, no. Okay, I get it. I understand. The point was, if God can say, I've got all of this includes your story, your life, your situation. If I can put everything exactly where it needs to be to make this world the way that it is, perfect for my purposes, I've got you. Trust me. He's even given that permission by offering sacrifices for himself, for his family, and even those stupid friends that were being pawns, if you will, of Satan behind the scenes the entire time. And so that's God saying, listen, you don't know what your life's like. I can see all of it. I've seen it all. I'm in control. So the idea of knowing that we could die before finishing this Bible class is scary because we don't know what's beyond. But God's already been there. He's there right now. And so if Job can say, all right, I trust you, then we can too. It's easy to say, though. Really hard to do in the moment. That's why we talk about it so often, is to kind of say, listen, when you get into a moment where you say you want to fear, want to panic, have anxiety, then think about these lessons. We've never really been in control anyway. And God has brought us this far. So
it's scary, Alan, but it's also comforting. And I know that's easy to say, but,
yeah.
You know, whenever I've gone through difficult times in my life, that's, you know, somebody said to me, well, wonder why this or wonder why that. I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Don't mess with the foundation of everything that I believe in. And it was somebody who I respected a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that, don't even put a crack in my thought process right now, because that's the only way I can deal with it.
Yeah.
Is knowing that it ultimately doesn't matter because he's in control. And I can, you know, as you've referenced by the Bible and already this morning, you know, I was writing Philippians 3 yesterday, and Paul was talking about those of us who are mature, you know, think this way. And whenever you see somebody like me, observe who's walking this way, you know, and that's what's, if you're not in that mindset that God is in control, it can just make you go the other way. And that's the balance that we need to get to, of doing everything and not letting it crack in the foundation.
Met a guy yesterday. I drove yesterday. I was from Ladson to Goose Creek to downtown to Mount Pleasant to downtown to Mount Pleasant, downtown to Mount, you get the deal. And then John's Island, Angel Oak, and then up 17 to West Ashley, and then back home. So I was all over, was my point. But there was one guy that stood out. That's usually never a good thing. When you have one guy out of like 17 that stand out, you really got to make an impression. It's in Mount Pleasant, so I already have an opinion of what the person's going to be like in my mind, just judging everyone on Mount Pleasant equally. Right, Penny? They're in a category. And so I pull up into the suburb, and it's, I don't know what they're called. It's a house that's like two houses that are split down the middle. What's that called? A duplex. That's the word. Makes sense. And so I was a duplex. I'm like, I've never seen a duplex in Mount Pleasant. This is odd. There are. Well, I found them. So it's all the way up 17.
I lived.
You lived in one?
For a little bit.
Until you. Okay. Pull up, and there's a guy. I'm looking for a person that's looking at the road with a cell phone in their hand. This is my signal. That's my person, right? Usually. The name's a secondary. So I see a guy in the driveway, and he's holding his phone in the driveway, like where I should be, and he's looking at the cell phone like this. And he's maybe 40, maybe 40. And he's standing like this. And then I saw out of the corner of my eye, he goes, I'm like, yeah. Immediately, I was like, that's not usual. It's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Someone doing that seems a little weird. I'm like, all right, you never know. Maybe the guy, I don't know, autistic. Maybe he's, you know, maybe I don't know what's going on. So I pull up, and as soon as I pull up, he looks at me just like this with the eyes wide open. And I'm like, oh, he's completely drunk. Like, that's what that looks like. Got it. So I'm like, what am I going to do? Okay, I can give the guy a ride safely and get him where he's supposed to go and risk him getting sick in the front seat. I could just pull off and hope that somebody else can deal with him if I feel like I'm threatened here safety-wise. But we pull up, and then he's like trying to direct me. I need to back up to go where he's supposed to go. So he gets into the, can I sit up front? I'm like, yeah, you can sit up front. Now I can guarantee you've had way too much to drink at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And so I look, and it says stop one, stop two. So I go, oh, we have two stops. He goes, yeah, we're just going down to Publix, and we're coming right back here. And I go, okay, so 5 minutes one way, 5 minutes the other way. I'm like, this is going to be a long trip. I can't wait for more than 5 minutes if you go into a store. And he goes, oh, no, we're going to a liquor store. I go. So what are we going to do here? It's like, well, he's already drunk. He wants to get more. Am I? Just doing my job, man, trying to serve here the people that really need it. And so I'm like, all right, well, he's going to go anyway. I guess I'll take him and try to have a conversation along the way if he's up for it. So I'm like, all right, let's go. So he gets to the car, and he's kind of going, he's talking. I'm like looking for marks on the arm to see if it's just alcohol or what else is going on. I'm like, he's not messed up or anything. So I'm like, I think he's just drunk. And so he's talking about a bunch of stuff. And then along the way, it comes out what's going on. What's going on is he is a veteran, and he did 3 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he just got home, and he has 6 kids with him and his wife. 3 are his, and then 3 are from his wife. And so he's got a house full of kids and a wife who's at work. And the kids are not there right now. They're in school. But he is watching the news, and he sees what's going on in Iran. And he gets a letter in the mail. And the letter says, you were officially dismissed at this certain date 3 years ago. We have the right to call you into active duty within 2 years of your release date. So he goes, just so you're aware, you may be going over. And he does not want to go. So his solution was not the best solution. Just getting blitzed drunk was not going to fix his problem. He was just trying to forget about the problem right now. But that's where he was. And so we talked about it a little bit, and he kind of got sidetracked, as you do, apparently. And he's kind of going left and right there, pulls up, he buys more alcohol, and on the way back, I'm like, this is not going to fix the problem, you know? And he goes, I know. Just one more day. I go, okay, it's just one more day. I mean, I'm glad you're taking it one day at a time, but this is a little bit not the way to do that. I said, all right, man, well, I'll be praying for you. And he gets out of the car. I didn't even mention that I was a preacher, because that was going to probably make him feel even worse. I didn't say I was a Christian. I just talked about trying to handle the stress of what he was going through. It was not the right time to go into whole evangelistic mode. And then on the way out, for whatever reason, he just said, God bless you. And he got out, and he went to the house. And so I'm not sure I handled all that right or did the right thing, but that's a guy who's in the middle of it. And so it's easy to say, yeah, God's got this, don't worry. But when you got 6 kids and a wife and you're going to be shipped over somewhere else, possibly, soon, that fear is at your front door. And so that's just one dude out of 17 I met yesterday. So it's interesting who God sends my way. All right, last thought I want to get to real quick here is, did you read chapter 2? If you did, you got to a point to where he had heart palpitations. Which when I read it, I was like, oh yeah, okay. Now it makes more sense. For those that don't know, I got here in 2015 after 18 long months of looking for the right place to go. To say it was stressful is a little bit of an understatement, to say the least. Waking up at 1 in the morning, literally panicking that we're going to be homeless, it was tough. It wasn't the toughest thing in the world. I understand that. It's all relative. But it's the toughest thing I've ever been through when it comes to something like that. Maddie being born was probably tougher, but that was shorter than 18 months of fear. When I got here, everything's great. I love y'all. Things going well, right? Except for every now and again, my heart will just go to 200 beats a minute, stay there for a couple of seconds, stop, and then go back to normal. And so, like, the first time it happened, I was like, well, that's too much caffeine. I'll just get decaf from now on. Wasn't the caffeine, ironically. And so, 2 minutes left. And so I talked to someone who I thought maybe knew some people in the medical field. Little did I know, it was the exact right person to ask. I said, do you know anyone that deals with, like, heart stuff? And the person just gave me a name. Like, oh, perfect. So you actually know. Great. You're the right person. I'm so glad I trusted you. And so I'm fearful of telling anyone because I'm like, I just got here. I don't want to make you think I'm dying or anything. I don't want to panic anybody, but I also don't want to have a heart attack. So anyway, long story short, it's a heart arrhythmia. Not a big deal. Not life-threatening, but also very scary. I put on a beta blocker for a little bit until that had some side effects I didn't like too much. So now we're good to go on that. But him saying he had heart palpitations and then he just prayed it away was like, eh? Not sound medical advice, in my opinion. I don't think praying it away would have been the thing that would have helped me a lot. My symptoms slowly went away and I never went to the doctor. It's like, I mean, you could have gone to the doctor just to get an echo done and see if you're okay. But that was his decision. My decision was I should probably figure out what's going on. Before it gets any worse. So the idea here is he was stressed out. He was overwhelmed, and it had a physiological reaction to him, which he treated in a very non-medical way. I think it's interesting that he says that there's not really people that are naturally joyous. People that are naturally worriers that kind of dependent on the situation and your upbringing and what's going on in your life, that all affects you in a very serious way. One thing that I didn't notice in here, which I don't think he says, which I think is an important distinction, is the difference between joy and happiness. I've mentioned this before for sermons. Happiness is an emotion that you feel, right? I use the illustration often, if you figured out that you just won the lottery, how are you going to feel? A little excited, never have to work a day in your life again, go to work and quit in front of your boss that you don't like that much. So that's a happy feeling, right? Then you figure out that it's actually a mistake and you're not a millionaire or a billionaire. You have to go back to work the next day. Not going to feel that happy. That's an emotion that you feel. You're not going to feel happiness all the time. We're not supposed to. That's the whole idea of why we're in this world with good and bad. But joy is a little bit different. Because Paul wrote about the idea of rejoicing while he was literally chained to a desk, right in the New Testament. So joy is a little bit different. We'll pick this up next week, Lord willing, and finish out chapter 2, and then we'll move on to chapter 3. So if you feel ambitious, you can read chapter 3. All right? Thanks so much for your attention. We'll be dismissed now for about 15 minutes before worship.